Welcome to another episode of COVID Chronicles, a podcast by, for, and about people affiliated with Portland Mennonite Church in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum, and my guest is Colleen Milstein. Colleen, I am so glad that we finally found a time to do this. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Colleen, the first thing that people notice when you start to speak is that you don't sound like you were a United States-born person. Tell me about where you were born.
I was born in South Africa in a tiny, tiny little village in the northwest of the country.
So what would your closest big city be that we might have heard of?
Probably Pretoria or Johannesburg. We were really in the middle of nowhere. My father was an ornithologist, so he was super excited to be in the middle of nowhere where there was a little bit of water and some weird birds flying by. So that's, we were at a research station in the middle of nowhere. South Africans have never heard of the place. So
where were your parents from originally? I mean, it sounds like your father picked this place on purpose, but I'm assuming that you had family somewhere else in South Africa. What's that story?
Yeah, my father's side of the family was around, both sides of the family were from the north of the country, Pretoria, Johannesburg area, and then further north. My mom's parents farmed up way closer to Zimbabwe. Pine trees at a farm where they grew everything, a lot of citrus, cotton, tomato, potatoes, tobacco, all kinds of stuff. Yeah, so they were more up north. So we're more from the north of the country for about the last, I'd say, 80 years.
How many siblings do you have and where do you fit in your family?
I am the youngest. I have an older brother, Roger, and an older sister, Shelley.
And at this point in their lives, where are they?
And we are spread throughout the world. Roger and his family live in Perth, Australia. And my sister is a teacher in the international school system, and currently she is in India and loving it. She was just on a tiger safari. So we are trying to see how many continents we can live on in our lifetime, but they both plan to come here in the summer.
Now that COVID hopefully is on its way out and travel is more possible.
That's what we're hoping. We'll see.
Tell me about growing up in this small part of South Africa, this little research station. Who were your friends? Who were the neighbors?
Well, we were actually only there when I was very little. And then we moved to another small village nearer to Pretoria, about half an hour from Pretoria. Our village was called Irene. It had four streets and with little dirt roads in between. And it was wonderful. We had a local primary school in the area. We just lived and played outside all day. And then in the holidays or vacation in America, in the holidays, we would go up to my grandparents' farm. My mother had died when I was little. She died when I was six, and she was an only child. So we used to go to her parents every holiday, and they were up on the farm. And then it was just crazy farm life, a lot of friends, yeah, in an even smaller village, Heinertsburg. So a lot of small villages seem to be my story.
What happened with your mother?
Well, it started as breast cancer, but by the time, started when she was 33 and she died at 36, and then the cancer was everywhere in her body, throughout her back. So she died real young. And it was weird because both of her, like her paternal and maternal grandmothers and mothers kind of lived to over 100. So it was just a freak then that nobody understands.
Did your father ever remarry, or at least when you were growing up?
Yes, several times. So initially, about a year or so after my mom died, he had three little kids. We were 6, 8, and 9. And that marriage was about 12 years. And then he remarried several times after that. Yeah.
So that made for kind of an interesting growing up, didn't it?
Yeah, it did. In our family tradition, we go to boarding school. So we know from little kids, and it's a big, exciting thing. It's like all the British boarding school stories. So we know the songs, we know about the midnight feasts and the hostel ghosts. And so we all went to boarding school, and that was a saving grace for me to get out of the home when I was about 12 years old. I went to school my mom had been at, and it was wonderful. But that really did help.
And so when you say boarding school, I think some distance from home. Where did you go and how far was that?
Ours wasn't that far. It was about 40 minutes or something. So it was more linked to the tradition than the commute. So in our family, both sides of my family, for high school, senior and high school in America, yeah, you go to boarding school. So from when you're about 12 till 18, you go and then you home every second weekend, you come home. Yeah.
Boarding school means that you're living with the other students. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I'm in the girls' school, Pretoria High School for Girls, and my brother's across the railway line at Boys High. And the bridge club and ballroom dancing clubs were very popular because it was the only one where the girls and the young gentlemen from across the railway line got together. So we all did ballroom dancing, bridge, etiquette classes. And then, we had about 60 girls in two hostels, and you all had your own little cubicle. The big excitement was if you could get into dormitory that had three people in, you really lobbied to get into dormitory and be with your friends. But it was a great experience in terms of lifelong friendships, a lot of fun, a very packed schedule, sports, culture. You had to do clubs and a lot of sports. And I loved it. I loved school.
Did you have a best friend during those school years?
I had several, actually. Boarding school, you tended to be in a group. So there were a group of us that are now also, one's in Australia, one's in the UK, one's in Canada, one's in America. So we kind of spread. And then one of my closest friends is in South Africa, that we're actually working on a big project together now. So there was a group of us. The boarders were, the people in boarding school are called boarders, and the girls who come in every day are day bugs. And the boarders tended to be a very close, close group and stayed in touch, yeah.
So as you were getting into, say, the high school years, were there certain subjects or ideas that were percolating in you in terms of what you might want to, quote unquote, be when you grew up?
I think with the South African context, you know, as a kid growing up under apartheid, when you're little, as a kid, you just don't notice things. So then when you're like 8, 9, you start, I noticed on the farm that my friend's school was awful. While I had a wonderful school with, you know, green sports fields and a swimming pool, and they were like in a one-roomed place with no glass in the windows, my black friends. And so you start looking at that, and our school happened to be, it's one of the oldest schools in South Africa and was very liberal, which in South Africa means you're not a racist. And so because of that, we did a lot of, our school was involved a lot in political justice issues. And then I think as a follower of Jesus, I always had this thing in me that I wanted to be part of changing stuff, working for justice, development, ending poverty. I think from pretty young kid, that was a big drive in me.
I actually wrote down the word apartheid before we started this interview, because you obviously were growing up when that was still, I don't know if you call it the law of the land or how you would explain that. But it sounds to me like your sort of day-to-day life, everyone was white. And then at a certain point, you started to realize, wait a minute, there are others and it's not as good for them. Can you just talk a little bit about the whole apartheid idea?
Yeah. So in apartheid, there were four different race categories and you all lived in your own area and it was illegal to go to another area. Except black people would come into white areas basically to work. So after my mom died, her best friend who worked for us, she pretty much, Rebecca raised me. And the different like house help that my parents had who were living on the property pretty much became my mother. So I always had a strong connection with black culture. And then also being on the farm, that was a majority black environment again. But you pretty much, yeah, even in boarding school, the black people that you were around were people who worked there. You weren't engaging outside of getting involved through church activities. The racial segregation was so strong, is there just was no crossover. But then by the time I'm in my teenage years in the 80s, late 80s, apartheid is starting to come to the end. they'd been trying to get Mandela to come out, but commit to not talk, and he refused. But pretty much the last whites-only referendum, I think, was when I was 17 or 18. And then soon after that, we had, you know, declared our president at the time just announced unilaterally, nobody expected it, that he was unbanning the African National Congress, unbanning South African Communist Party, and releasing Nelson Mandela and Govan Mbeki and many of our leaders in the struggle. That was in my few years after school. And at the time, I was working in the slums, just trying to figure out my country. I was immersed there. So that was my world. So I think it was, I feel in many ways, I only got to know my country when I started working in the squatter camps, because you in this little white bubble. And even when you're involved in protest and activism, it still is from a, you know, position of privilege. It's like protesting in Portland. You still are like, yeah, but you get to go home and nobody chases you because of your race if you've got a broken taillight. So I think it was only when I got in the slums that I really got the reality of what apartheid had done. And I knew it theoretically and philosophically, and it fought against it, but I didn't get it until I worked in the squatter camps.
Tell me what you remember about the day that Nelson Mandela was released from jail. I used to work at the MCC Africa Department, and we had a picture of him up on the wall, and I was there the day he was released, and I remember that poster coming down and everyone rejoicing, but that wasn't anything like what it was for you, I'm sure.
No, it was, I got in a car with a Brit and a South African, a little beetle. And we started driving into Cape Town, and we went in about 5 hours early because we wanted to be at the parade. He was getting released from Victor Verster prison and then was making his way to Cape Town. And it was like a different country. I mean, overnight in the townships where I was working, it was spray painted on the walls that there were free buses to go at the parade, which is where he was going to address the nation. And those came up overnight. I mean, the infrastructure organization was amazing. And then I remember being in this little beetle, driving up in a Cape Town, which was probably about to get to the city, maybe 40, 45 minutes. And there were just buses with the ANC flag, which had been banned. So it was the first time you were seeing it in the open. And it was like a whole country exploded. And then you get to the parade and there are thousands of people. And now Mandela's coming. What we hear later is he's getting released from jail, but there are thousands of people to welcome him the whole way. You know, one of the things he was saying was his shock. And so he took hours. He was supposed to be at the parade, I think, at 2 and got there like at 7 or something, or something crazy. So we would be in the parade, and then Busak, one of the leaders in the struggle, would say, "You want my Madiba?" And everybody would shout, "Yes," and then he wouldn't come for another 2 hours. But you were literally lifted up in this crowd outside the parade. It's like an open place, and then the city hall. And there's a balcony he was going to speak on, and there are palm trees in the square. And finally, we were just holding hands around the palm trees because the crowd was just taking you, you know, and then someone would pass out from the heat or something, and there'd be an ambulance. But it was a crazy, wild day, just such excitement, waiting. It was like it wasn't real, you know. It was so quick from when de Klerk announced they were releasing him to the day he's released, and you're just cheering and shouting, and apartheid ended like that. I think it was like when the Berlin Wall came down, like the externals of apartheid ended like that. Like suddenly it wasn't, where I was working, it was illegal for me to work where I'd been working in the slum, and we were the only whites in that community. About 12,000 people, the police were too scared to go in. So it was, suddenly we weren't illegal anymore. Though we'd been illegal by then for, I don't know, 3-4 years. So it was this weirdo thing that changed overnight. So it was just the celebration and getting lifted off your feet in a crowd and thinking, this is crazy. I better not tell my father where I am.
And then were you actually able to hear him when he spoke?
You couldn't hear anything by the end of that. We were gone. It was crazy. And then some guy started looting on the side. So in the end, yeah, I didn't get to hear him. We were just there. And then it was it. It was done. And then I heard it later on TV.
Wow, that's truly an incredible story.
It was a great day.
So it sounds like after you graduated from high school or whatever you called it in South Africa, mm-hmm. that you went to work immediately or found you didn't go on to school right away. Is that true?
Yeah, I went and I actually did a course with a mission organization in South Africa and then started working in the slums and then was studying correspondence at the same time while I was doing that. Correspondence, is that what you call it? Distance learning. Yeah, I did distance learning.
And what was your experience with church growing up? You've mentioned it briefly.
Yeah, so I was raised in the same church from when I was young. It was a Methodist church. We actually had a Texan missionary who was our youth pastor who had a real walk with Jesus. And I think for me initially, I mean, one of my earliest memories of God is after my mom died, is saying to God, why did you take her? And it was just such a thing because it's like, well, if he's big and strong, why would he do this? And it's one of my clearest memories is God just saying, I'm good. And that was foundational for me. So he didn't answer why he took her, but he just said he was good. And so I kind of stuck with church then early teenage years, didn't want to get up and go. My dad made us go. And then somewhere around 13, 14, just grappling with South Africa and kind of saying, God, if Christianity is true, well, why do we use religion then to justify apartheid? Because that had been done for so long. You know, there was a Christian basis, Christian, whatever way that is, basis to apartheid. But really started going, if I'm going to follow Jesus, then it's everything. And that was a real radical turn in my life, wanting to really grapple with my faith. And if I was going to call myself a Christian, I had to be fighting against the system. And I had to say that the system was evil. And there was a lot of Christian standing against apartheid. There were a lot of initiatives of white people going to stay in black people's homes, Christians, just to get to know each other, build trust and relationship. A lot of peace. We'd hold hands and make human chains across the countries for peace and washing feet in football stadiums and repenting and stuff. So there was a lot of that. So I think my faith is very central to my life because it was either Jesus existed, and if he did, that's got implications. And if he didn't, then party it up. Just do what you want with your life, make a lot of money, get a house in Cape Town, and live a good life. So it was that kind of clear choice. So, yeah, stayed involved with the church, got frustrated with the church, but also saw incremental changes. All the churches in South Africa repented of apartheid. They formally said they were wrong as part of the process. Yeah.
What happened next? You were working in the slums, taking some correspondence courses, and were you finding some kind of a trajectory, like this is kind of a specific area that I might want to work in, or tell me that story?
Yeah, I pretty much had set my focus on development, on how do you develop a nation? So how do you end poverty? How do you bring economic justice? And so while I was working in the slums, I studied development and theology. So I really wanted to understand just different questions around the scriptures and how do you trust the scripture as well as development? How do you develop a nation? What has to be in place for a nation to develop, not just economically and lose its soul, but how do you develop cultures? How do you see family strengthened? And pretty much that's what I've done the last 30 years. I was based out of South Africa. I was in the slums about 6 years directly. And then I was working, training staff in a mission organization across Africa. Then I was asked to be based out of Switzerland to do that. Just because of flights in Africa, it's cheaper to fly in from Europe than across the continent. Now it's changing, but it wasn't like that in the 90s, 2000s. So I was based in Switzerland for 10 years, but was getting more and more kind of in an organizational hierarchy and felt us further from the poor. And so that's when I moved to the States and we started a nonprofit.
Who's we?
I moved here with a team of people. So Jana Motes is one of them, but there were a group of us that came at the same time, really with an intention to go, could we start a nonprofit and look at doing development different in Africa? How do you really come alongside local guys in their community doing stuff and support that initiative? So really mobilizing them. So it's really, it has just been development. And then I did my grad degree in also in global development and justice. And that's the trajectory I'm still on.
So when you came to the States, did you come straight here to Portland, or was there a journey in the United States as well?
I had done a lot of lecturing, so flying back and forth in the States. And so we had been looking and kind of trying to figure out where in America we'd want to land. And we wanted to be where internationals would feel welcome and people of different races. We didn't want to be in the Bible Belt. I mean, just certain thinking around Christianity we didn't want. And so we pretty much targeted the Pacific Northwest. And then Portland, Seattle, I used to get snowed in. I had so many flights canceled that I didn't want to live in Seattle. It was too extreme. And the parts I'd like to live in California, I didn't want to live or I couldn't afford. And so we hit on Oregon and then we hit on Portland. So I think the volunteerism of the city, the innovative thinking, and then the beauty of the place. Basically, we needed high-speed internet and international airport. And Portland gave us that. So yeah, we pretty much moved to Portland.
And what year was that?
2010.
And then at some point, you found Portland Mennonite Church. What's the story there? Were you familiar with Mennonites? You mentioned that the peace idea was something from way back, but...
No, I was not familiar with Mennonites. I'm still learning. I understood some of the thinking theologically and like that after being based in Switzerland and studying some of those guys. But yeah, struggled to really find a church I could fit into and so I was part of helping to do a church plant down in Lentz. And then Jenna, a friend of mine, she had started going to PMC and was really enjoying it. And I went a couple of times and just thought, this is it. I think the teaching, Rod, Kurt, Britt, at the time, the three of them, just, you know, the Sunday worship, but also just the integration of people. The church actually feels a lot like the church I grew up in terms of size and high people involvement. And I think, if I'm really blunt, it was like being in America, I was starting to go, I don't even want to say I'm a follower of Jesus, because the way we talk about Jesus or how we're using Christianity. And at PMC, I felt like I could follow Jesus without being embarrassed, the way we were talking about him and his ways. And that was super important for me. I felt like I got a break from trying to say to people, we don't all think like that. And so I think that was partly just a real comfort to go, okay, I'm not going absolutely crazy. You can love and follow Jesus and not support these things.
So. Just the word Christian here in this country seems to have a very different connotation than in maybe other places.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think PMC was really just the mental comfort that I wasn't losing my mind.
And now you're even a member of The Table, our leadership group. And we're thrilled that you are on The Table. Tell me a bit about how that happened and what your role on it is.
I'm chair-elect. I'm still learning all it is. I think it's more than I thought it was going to be. But Dave approached me to be, you know, whether I would take the role and work alongside him. And Harold had actually written to me way back, but I was traveling in Africa at the time and missed it. And I'd kind of been praying about it, going, how can I be involved and serve the church and what am I actually good at and stuff. So I can see, you know, I'm still learning. My eyes are wide open, trying to figure out, okay, how does this work and who makes what decision and how are people engaged and how do you get other people engaged and how do we go forward the next 5 to 10 years? I think that's what I'm pondering. It's like, I think the next 5 to 10 years in PMC are going to be crucial because they're going to be changes. And just kind of go, what is our strategic plan in moving forward? What do we want to really hold on to real tight? What do we want to develop? So I think that's probably where I live in my mind in general with organizations. And so that's kind of what I'm pondering and praying over with PMC is how do we keep this wonderful entity that we've got and set it up for decades to come.
And tell me a bit about what your actual work is now. You've been in Portland since 2010, and you're running I don't know, I can't tell how many organizations, but tell us just a bit about what your work is and who you work with.
Okay. I work with a nonprofit called Loom International. And the concept of a loom is something that you weave on. That's where the word loom comes from. And our concept was, Jenna Motes, who's in PMC, was the founder. And the concept is that we work with local experts, social innovators in their community around the world. And they are the ones who know their communities best. They're the ones who bring in the beauty in their community. And so we are loom. We're a tool. If they say they need resources, like mental health right now is a huge thing. So we're pursuing different resources to get out to the guys. Then they can contextualize it. They tell us this is brilliant, this is dumb. And we really serve as their secretaries in that. We believe that we're in a time in the world where Africa and Asia have to direct a lot more development and even thinking within global church. So most of the guys we work with are faith-based, but not all. And we're in the process of launching a collaboration called Thrive Africa that Loom is directing. And it pretty much is bringing together about 50 organizations working in 35 nations in Africa in the areas of healthcare, education, infrastructure, and I've forgotten the last one. But basically, we're targeting these four areas. And so we have prosthetic workshops with one of our partners. We have a lot of schools, preschools, primary schools, vocational schools. We have clinics, different healthcare initiatives. Agriculture is another one. So we've got a collaboration where we're waiting finally on our funding to come through, and it should be in the next month or so. And then this is a 15-year project that we'll launch in those 35 countries. So that's my job. And that's our team. So we're going to go in a major scale up. We just need the money to land, and then the party begins.
So where do you get your funding, or how do you get your funding?
We have individuals that support us, and we get different grants. And then this particular one is a huge international foundation that has to give money to humanitarian work that we got in contact with. And so they come in behind us to do this.
And is your focus only on Africa, or is it broader than that?
For this initial phase, for about 2 years, we're going to keep the focus on Africa. We have worked more globally, and then to develop some prototypes and really bring ideas down to time and space, we started working only in Africa. But we've been invited to look at different projects that are kind of brewing in a similar concept as Thrive Africa. We also have like the domain name Thrive Asia and different projects going. So we will expand it. And the funders keep saying, you know, could you look at Latin America? And I'm like, just show me the money. Let us get 2 to 3 years under our belt. And then, yes, I will happily go broader again.
Oh, Colleen, thank you so much for just giving us the tip of the iceberg of your amazing life and the incredible work that you're doing. We are so blessed and grateful to have you at Portland Mennonite as part of us.
Thank you, Gloria. I love PMC, so I am glad to be there.
And thank you for joining us for this episode of COVID Chronicles. If something you heard raised questions, or if you discovered a connection, take the opportunity to reach out and continue the conversation. I'm your host, Gloria Nussbaum. Until next time, stay well and keep the faith.